Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist and author Danny Schechter, who assesses the historic Federal Communications Commission June 2nd vote, which abandoned rules restricting the concentration of media ownership, Joshua Rubenstein of Amnesty International USA, who discusses his group's concern that the U.S. war on terrorism has made the world a more dangerous place, and Plowshares peace activist Mark Koval, who describes his participation in a May 25th direct action protest on the guided missile cruiser USS Philippine Sea in New York Harbor. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Irish rock star Bob Geldof, creator of the Live Aid concerts in the 1980s, is back in Africa trying to raise awareness of the massive famine gripping Ethiopia. The country has not had significant rain for 3 years, and today 14 million Ethiopians must rely on food aid. Prime Minister Meles Zenawi says Ethiopia faces a crisis worse than the 1984 famine that shocked the world. On a brief Africa tour only days before the G8 summit in Evian, France, Geldof blasted the European Union for scrimping on food aid and asked that they release whatever aid it can get its hands on. Clearly, Geldof was trying to get the attention of Western leaders who are consumed with the aftermath of the US-led invasion of Iraq. The rock star told the BBC, "South of Iraq is another country which is facing utter catastrophe this summer because it has failed to receive over two-thirds of the food requirements it was promised. The crisis can easily be seen in a healthcare clinic 3 hours south of the capital city of Addis Ababa. The wards are filled with severely malnourished women and children. A five-year-old girl was so weak that she could not even swallow a few sips of milk." Disaster struck in mid-May when 19 Latino immigrants died from heat exhaustion and dehydration in a trailer truck abandoned at a truck stop in South Texas. While the number of immigrant deaths in this incident set a record, it was only part of a long pattern of death in the hot desert. According to The Nation magazine, the death toll has skyrocketed since the Clinton administration beefed up the border patrol in cities in California and Texas. Now, growing numbers of immigrants put their lives at risk by walking through the deserts of the American Southwest, or pay up to $2,000 a person to be smuggled in. The Clinton-era Southwest Border Strategy, which is still in effect, uses a prevention-through-deterrence approach that puts up more walls and hired hundreds of new border agents. Former Tucson Border Patrol Chief Ron Sanders, who patrolled over 280 miles of desert, says the government border strategy has failed. All it accomplished was killing people, he observed. Wayne Cornelius, a leading U.S. expert on Mexican immigration, says the U.S. border strategy is the most systematic violation of human rights occurring on U.S. soil today. The U.S.-Mexican border is clearly one of the most dangerous land borders anywhere in the world. The National Family Farm Coalition denounced a May 13th complaint to the World Trade Organization filed by the US, Argentina, Canada, Egypt, and 9 other nations which challenged the European Union's limits on genetically modified organisms, also known as GMOs. While US Department of Agricultural Secretary Ann Veneman claims to be fighting for the rights of small farmers, GMO crops benefit only the corporate agribusiness, especially Monsanto, the most aggressive proponent of GMOs. Missouri farmer Bill Christensen related in the In Motion magazine that if he were to use Monsanto's Roundup system on his crops, he'd have to use 5 to 6 times the amount of chemicals. Massive uses of Roundup facilitates a fungus which triggers sudden death syndrome in soybeans, greatly reducing yields, Christensen said. Critics say that there are other dangers with GMO use aside from lower crop yield. Modifying plants to allow for greater use of herbicides affects the health of farm workers. Also, the modified genes can spread to wild plants and weeds, giving them resistance to herbicides and can cross-pollinate with organic crops. Ignoring the dangers of GMOs and the outrage of the European nations, the US has used famine as leverage for pushing the GMO agenda. When Southern Africa faced drought in 2002, the US pressured many African nations into accepting GMO corn. Zambia refused. This past May, the Biodevastation Conference in St. Louis focused on the link between genetic engineering and racism, as companies like Monsanto use GM foods to push poor people off their land, transform their victims into terrorists if they resist, and contaminate their food supply. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Britta Brundage. For Between the Lines, I'm Prue Cullen.
In a historic June 2nd vote, the Federal Communications Commission, chaired by Bush administration appointee Michael Powell, abandoned regulations in force for decades, which had restricted the concentration of ownership of the nation's print and broadcast media outlets. In a party-line 3-2 vote, the Republican-dominated commission put in place new regulations that will allow a company to own up to 3 television stations, 8 radio stations, a daily newspaper, and a cable TV provider in the nation's largest cities. The new rules will also permit national networks to own TV stations that reach 45% of U.S. households, up from 35%. Chairman Powell maintained that the most sweeping media deregulation in a generation will promote diversity, localism, and competition. But a bipartisan coalition of media activists, consumer groups, and members of Congress charge that these new rules will have an opposite effect by creating ever larger monopolies, which will limit the diversity of viewpoints and undermine local programming. In response to what many viewed as an undemocratic process leading up to this vote, a grassroots media democracy movement was born, inspiring court challenges and federal legislation seeking to overturn the FCC rules changes. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with journalist and author Danny Schechter, who, over the last 4 decades, worked for both corporate and independent media. He assesses the effect FCC deregulation will have on our democracy and the movement now organizing to take back the public airwaves.
Reed Hunt, the former FCC commissioner under Clinton in the first term, basically said, in his view, that this was a right-wing power grab. And he put it in a political context that none of the journalists who are covering all this really have put it in. They tend to look at this as a bunch of specific rules and regulations, and it's kind of complicated. It's stuck in the business section. Your eyes glaze over when you try to understand it. Only lawyers can make any sense out of, ownership caps. 35% of the country now becomes 45% of the country ownership for individual media companies. Now there's a restriction on a newspaper owning media outlets in the same town in which they operate. That's being lifted, leading to what's being called duopolies. Most people don't really know anything about it because these issues are not covered with any regularity. The media really covers itself and its own interests as thoroughly as it covers other people's interests, and is really accountable or transparent often about those interests. So here we have, a set of regulations that media companies, including the New York Times Company, lobbied for, which means spent a lot of money on lawyers and political donations and who knows what else, to try to convince the FCC to deregulate and allow them, in essence, to make more money and to have more power. And the question is, how is that going to benefit our country, and is it? And many of the critics, of which I am one, and MediaChannel.org has been writing about this every day, basically what we're saying is that this, in fact, will erode diversity, put more power in fewer hands, lead to more media concentration, and in essence, kind of end the idea that the public interest is is something that needs to be regulated to protect. In other words, when you put somebody into a regulatory agency who tells you on day one, I don't believe in regulation, he's in the wrong job, or is he? And that's the question that we're dealing with. What is going on here, and why are so many people so upset about it? 750,000 people commented on this with kind of an unprecedented response. People went to meetings all across America. Michael Powell refused to debate the issue with Ted Koppel or even appear on Nightline because critics were on the same show. There's been an effort to just jam this down our throats, and many people are furious about it.
Do you think the public is satisfied with the media as it is? And if not, how are they expressing their dissatisfaction?
Well, there are two things I can comment on this. First of all, when asked about the media, which is very rare when people are actually polled about the media, the Pew Center did some polls, found 70% of the people dissatisfied with media, okay? The CNN Gallup poll last week only showed 35% satisfaction with the media. 70% of the people inside the media dissatisfied with the media. So that's just what they say when they're really asked about it, which is very rare, okay? And moreover, and more importantly, what we're seeing is that, you know, programs have certain ratings increases, but often the share overall viewing has gone down. Michael Copps, who's one of the FCC commissioners, I spoke with him earlier today, and he was telling me that when he went to hearings around the country and asked people, where do you get your news, he found more and more people saying the BBC. They weren't even watching news in American news anymore. And then he went to Phoenix for a hearing that he was organizing, and he asked people, where did you hear about the hearing? What, did you hear it on the local TV station, local radio stations? They said, no, they heard it on the BBC. So people have to go to England to find out what's happening in America. I mean, that's really pathetic and horrible commentary on our media system. But of course, you choose between the choices you're given. When you see that there are other choices, that's when you begin to realize, hey, this can be done differently. You turn on Canadian TV news, turn on BBC, turn on some of the other programming that's on there. Suddenly, other perspectives are out there, sometimes on PBS, sometimes on other outlets. You can find something that totally contradicts what you've been watching and hearing, okay? So the problem is that media companies don't cover media in any kind of a critical way, and that's why we set up mediachannel.org. So, yeah, most people say, yeah, they love it, they watch it, but that doesn't mean they necessarily like it.
And one word on hope, because I don't want to leave this on such a bleak note here. Danny Schechter, is there hope that media activists around the country and just ordinary citizens can pressure Congress to reverse these rules?
Well, I think what we saw is the emergence of a media movement on a scale that we've never seen it before. Nobody really knew about the FCC before. A lot of people know about it now. They're aware of the media problems. They're concerned about it. I think that's a very good sign. We need a media and democracy movement. We need a strategy of moving on the media, pressing the press, and holding media accountable. And I think that out of this battle will come that type of a movement. Michael Copps himself said, this is the end of the beginning, but the beginning of something new. And I think that does offer some hope.
That was Danny Schechter, executive producer at Global Vision. His latest book is titled Media Wars, which examines the U.S. press coverage of the war on terrorism. Visit Schechter's Media Watch website at www.mediachannel.org. As increasing numbers of U.S. soldiers are killed and wounded in ambush attacks across Iraq, and the search for Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction continues to come up empty-handed, many Americans are beginning to question the Bush administration's justification for their war against Baghdad. After the September 11th terrorist attacks in New York and Washington, the White House declared what they said could very well be an endless war against terrorism, which sent U.S. troops first to Afghanistan and then to the Persian Gulf, while curtailing civil liberties here at home. Contrary to international law, hundreds of prisoners captured in Afghanistan, some of them minors, have been held at the U.S. Navy's prison camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, without charge for up to 18 months. Attorney General John Ashcroft, under the authority of the USA Patriot Act, held hundreds of immigrants in secret detention without filing charges, while denying many of them access to attorneys or family members. Allegations that many of these immigrants were abused while in custody are supported in a recent investigation conducted by the Justice Department's Inspector General. In its annual report on global human rights released on May 28th, Amnesty International declared that Washington's war on terror has made the world more dangerous by curbing human rights, undermining international law, and shielding governments from scrutiny. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Joshua Rubenstein, Northeast Regional Director with Amnesty International USA, who discusses his group's concerns about the questionable tactics employed by the Bush administration to fight the terrorist threat.
Well, let me make clear that it's one thing to defend human rights at a time of calm prosperity. It's another thing to stand up for these principles at a moment of crisis. We all agree that after September 11th, the United States had to take vigorous methods, not only to prevent another attack, and we were all afraid that there would be another subsequent attack at that time, but also to investigate what happened and try to make sure that all those people responsible were held accountable, and we all wanted that to happen. But in the course of this war against terrorism, which is now going on for almost 2 years, Amnesty believes that there has been abuse of rights within the United States for those prisoners who are being held in Guantanamo, who were taken prisoner in Afghanistan, and the U.S. is countenancing abuse of human rights, even torture, among its allies. So all of those things taken together, we believe, are diminishing respect for human rights and are making giving the impression that the United States believes that human rights are dispensable when it comes to fighting terrorism.
There are many people in this country who support the wars. They support the pulling back of some human rights, some civil liberties, to protect this country. How does a country such as the United States in a time of crisis balance the security needs of its citizenry with safeguarding the heritage and rights enshrined in our Constitution and
sure.
the Bill of Rights?
Well, I think it's unfortunate that this tension between protecting our security and upholding human rights are seen as antagonistic. Let me say, as a citizen, as someone who lives here, is raising a family here, I want to feel secure here. And I want to feel that my government is doing what's necessary to protect me and my family and my friends and my community. However, it's also my job as a human rights activist, as a representative of Amnesty International, for my organization to point out what the red lines are, that we can sustain security and at the same time make sure that people have lawyers, that people have the right to a trial before a judge, that evidence is presented, that people are not subjected to torture or other forms of mistreatment. I do not believe, and I don't think the government would ever make the public claim, that our security depends on our ability to use torture or countenance torture by our allies. I don't think they would ever make such a public claim. I don't think it would be sustainable. We have to begin to understand that these principles of security, the necessity of security, and of upholding human rights are not antagonistic, that we can do both.
Tell us a little bit about the detainees at Guantanamo, the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo, Cuba.
Well, of course, this is a very unusual episode in American history, that after the attack on September 11th, the U.S. decided it had to overthrow the government of the Taliban, which had harbored, obviously, al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. In the course of that war, we detained over 600 people. We brought them to Guantanamo. Why? Because if they were to bring them to actual American territory in the 48 contiguous states or Alaska or Hawaii, they would be subject to American law. And we would have to give them lawyers. We would have to go through many, many procedures. But by keeping them in Guantanamo, we could go through the fiction of saying they were not on American territory. In fact, initially, the U.S. said it would not even abide by the Geneva Conventions and recognize them as prisoners of war. Instead, we've decided that they're enemy combatants. And so none of them has been charged with a crime. It's not clear they've been able to correspond with their families. There have been reported increasing incidents of suicide attempts by them, which indicates some degree of unpleasantness and unhappiness on their part. Finally, just this spring, we learned that there were a number of teenagers among these detainees, and they were being held indefinitely. So the U.S. government apparently has begun to release these teenagers and several elderly prisoners. Now it turns out that probably a number of these detainees were simply in the wrong place at the wrong time, that there was no concrete reason to detain them, to arrest them, to bring them to Guantanamo, that they were neither Taliban soldiers nor al-Qaeda soldiers. So these are many issues connected here. When the U.S. backs away from these human rights treaties, it's backing away from a tradition that it helped to create. The modern human rights movement emerged after World War II with the creation of the United Nations, with the tribunal at Nuremberg, with the development of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that was under the leadership of Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt, with the adoption of the Covenants on Civil and Political Rights and Social Economic Rights. It would be a tragedy if the U.S. were to turn its back on these decades of developments. The U.S. prides itself on being a leader of what used to be called the free world, being a champion of human rights, and the degree to which we back off from these rights, it makes it easier for regimes that are outright hostile to these principles. It just makes it easier for these governments to abuse their own people when there's no example from the United States saying international law matters, human rights matters. So it could have grave consequences for the rest of the world, and frankly, it could have consequences inside the United States, because our own civil liberties are under assault from things like the Patriot Act, from the fact that Americans can be arrested and held without trial now, that two Americans are being held without access to lawyers because of accusations that they're part of the conspiracy on September 11th. These are very worrisome things.
That was Joshua Rubenstein, Northeast Regional Director with Amnesty International USA. Contact Amnesty by calling area code 617-623-0202 or visit their website at www.amnestyusa.org. On May 25th, as hundreds of tourists were sightseeing aboard battleships in New York Harbor for the city's annual Fleet Week celebration, four peace activists hammered on missile launch hatches and threw their own blood on the deck of the guided missile cruiser USS Philippine Sea. In a statement released by the religious activists, they said, "With hammers, we have initiated the process of disarming this battleship, of transforming this carrier of mass destruction into a vessel for peace." The ship was the first U.S. Navy vessel to launch missiles on Afghanistan in 2001. Calling themselves the Riverside Plowshares were Brian Buckley of Virginia, Mark Koval of Connecticut, Joan Gregory of New York, and Sister Susan Clarkson of England. All are members of Catholic worker communities, which espouse nonviolent direct action against militarism in support of the poor. Although the four were arrested, they were not charged, and after a few hours in custody, they were released. During more than two decades of Plowshares peace protests, more than 150 people have participated in at least 70 actions in several countries that have targeted a range of weapons and delivery systems. Plowshares activists have served prison terms averaging 1 to 2 years, with the longest sentence being 18 years. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Plowshares activist Mark Koval at his home in New Haven, Connecticut, after his release by New York City police. He describes the recent action in New York Harbor and his philosophy of nonviolent resistance.
As soon as we started pouring the blood, these sailors backed away and backed the rest of the crowd away. And so they basically left us alone, where we had been concerned that, you know, obviously they were armed. There were armed guards patrolling the ship. We weren't sure what their reaction would be. There was a lot of, I have to say, a lot of professionalism exhibited by the sailors on the ship. They didn't mishandle us at all.
Now, I noticed on the video that was shot of the action, the sailor closest to you when you threw the blood didn't try to stop you at all, but just got on a cell phone right away and I guess was calling superiors. How many minutes were you kneeling there? You were displaying pictures, you were praying, you were also talking, some of you were talking directly to the crowd.
I think my estimate would be 15 to 20 minutes we were there. The sailors had pretty much surrounded us, but again, they were backed off, and it wasn't until officers of the ship came that we were finally arrested. The sailors were telling all of the people to ignore us. They said, just ignore them, and they were trying to show people the other weapons on the ship. It was kind of bizarre, but our friend Joan picked up on that, and Joan started addressing the people directly and saying, no, you can't ignore us. Pointing to the pictures, she said, this is what these weapons do. You can't close your eyes to this. You know, the blood is real. People were obviously distracted and looking at us. There were in the crowd, there were many children, which is very problematic for me in terms of how war is indoctrinated into our kids, almost without even noticing it. As we bring up children, they get indoctrinated into the normalcy of war. Our bottom line is nonviolence. And yet we need to bring the blood that is shed by these weapons back to the site from where they're launched so that the people who launch them can see it. And not only the people who launch them. I mean, in this day and age, in terms of war, people who pay taxes for war are just as directly connected to it as the people who press these buttons. to the sailors, it's a video game, you know, and they never see, I underline never see, the results of what they're doing.
You were there longer than you expected, and eventually some higher-ups from the military came and escorted you off the ship. And then I think you were kind of surprised by what happened later in the day, right?
Actually, we were arrested right there on the ship, and they brought us down the same way we came up. And so there was a large crowd of people who watched us being paraded down into a waiting van. And we were roundly booed by most of them, as you might imagine. We were expecting to be brought to jail, and we ended up sitting on the van for about 3 hours as there appeared to be some dispute between the police department and the federal agents about who was going to arrest us or hold us or what charges would be filed. The end result of all that was that about 3 hours later, we were told that we were going to be released.
Do you have any idea why you weren't charged?
It would be pure speculation on my part, but I am aware that there was a plowshares action done in Colorado recently for which 3 Catholic nuns were recently convicted, and they're awaiting sentencing in July. They're facing a minimum, as I understand it, a minimum of 6.5 years in prison. This has been big news, and so we think that maybe New York didn't want that kind of publicity coming up, particularly during Fleet Week. But that's just speculation. When you do these actions, you never know what the reaction's going to be. And so we were obviously shocked that we were released without charge.
You served about a year in prison for a previous plowshares action, so you weren't going into this naively. So why do you, Mark Colville, participate in these actions?
It's clear to me that our efforts for peace have to go beyond simple protest. Whenever our empire decides it's going to fight another war, we tend to hit the streets by the thousands and sometimes by the millions. And that's a beautiful thing. And yet our protest has got to translate into some kind of positive action. And I can think of no more positive action than the people taking the responsibility that governments are refusing to take, which is to disarm. Disarmament has got to happen if we're going to stop the next war. Disarmament has got to happen if we're going to pass on a world to the next generation.
That was Mark Koval of the Riverside Plowshares. For more information on the Plowshares movement, visit www.plowsharesactions.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Britta Brundage, Prue Cullen, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.